This week I have Picard, Last of Us, Mandalorian, and AEW Revolution. You know, if I actually did a show every week, I wouldn't have to do so much every damn time. I'm an idiot.
No sleep till!
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Ninja Warrior Podcast for March 6, 2023. I am your host, Greg Hernandez, and yeah, I really need to get better at that consistency thing. You know, I've only been doing this podcast for like 3 years, so eventually consistency that'll happen, you know, but progress is slow. That's progress is very slow, and damn it, I'm working on it. But we are back. We had a ton of new shows drop since I've been gone. What we have, first off, I'm going to start with Picard because that show, you know what, with Picard, I really hate to agree with the internet dicks. I really do. But every once in a while, damn it, you got to hang with the internet dicks. And here's what I mean. Season 3 has been awesome. It really has. And the internet dicks are talking about how season 3 is where we should have started with Picard. I'm on the fence about that one. I really am on the fence because I liked season 1. I really did. And here's where the internet dicks pissed me off. Because their main complaint, wait for it, their main complaint was that Captain Picard got old. Well, the fucking show ended 30 years ago. What did you expect to happen? Star Trek The Next Generation ended in 1994. See, that's where the internet dicks start to piss me off. The fucking show ended in 1994. That was almost 30 years ago. Just because I can pick up the remote and turn on my streaming service and watch Star Trek The Next Generation doesn't mean Patrick Stewart can't get old, okay? The fucking guy was 42 when the show started. Ironically, he's the exact same age Wil Wheaton is now. Look at those two fucking guys at 42, all right? Same age. Anyway, when you turn off that show, it doesn't take Patrick Stewart and put him in suspended animation. It doesn't, all right? The fucking show ended 30 years ago. Patrick Stewart is 30 years older from the time Next Generation ended to the time Picard started. You dumb shits. Okay? That I could not believe. That was the first complaint. Patrick Stewart or Captain Picard got old. I would be shocked if any of them actually knew his real name. He's either Captain Picard or Charles Xavier. Like, no. Real life happens, you dicks. It's been 30 years. Captain Picard is going to get old. And honestly, I thought it was a stroke of genius to take that passage of time and work it into Picard. Because if Picard had picked up about, let's say, a week after Star Trek Nemesis, it would have been ridiculous. If they had tried to take an 80-something-year-old Patrick Stewart and shoehorn him into a 45-year-old Captain Picard, it would have looked fucking ridiculous, and you guys would have bitched even more. So, anyway, it's a bit of a rant, and I apologize, but not really. I liked season 1. I thought what they did, the story they told to bridge that 30-year gap, was great. What happened to Picard after the Enterprise-D? What happened to the Federation? What happened to Will Riker? That one I will say, that one kind of bugged me a little bit. Would have been nice to see Will Riker still on the Titan. That would have been cool. He's still serving on the Titan because we've never got a live screen version of Titan. We haven't. Until now. I just got ahead of myself, but fuck it. We never got to see Will Riker on the bridge of the Titan, and that would have been cool. But anyway, I thought season 1 bridged that 30-year gap brilliantly. And if the internet dicks didn't like it, they can fuck off. But then we got Picard season 2. Not great. Not great, because one thing that Star Trek will always lean on, one thing that they will always do, they will always go back to time travel. Motherfucker. Oh my God. Star Trek does time travel the same way Star Wars does Skywalkers. Just all over the fucking place. Like, you don't need it everywhere. And season two was Captain Picard and his new merry band of misfits get fucking thrown back into the 90s. And now they have to, I don't even remember. Honestly, I don't even remember what season two was about. I remember seeing a fat old Whoopi Goldberg. I remember John DeLancey coming back as Q. That was cool. That was very cool. I did like that. But the rest of the season was just like, what are we doing here? Like, it was just, it was a wasted opportunity. I don't understand what season two was supposed to be about. So now we have season three, and goddammit, I'll admit, I was gun shy. I was really kind of leery about jumping back into season three after doing season two, because, guys, you ever have that thing where your girlfriend says, hey, do these jeans look good on me? And you're dumb enough to think she actually wants an honest answer? Remember how you never did that shit again? That's kind of how I feel. That's kind of the nervousness I feel toward Picard season three. I'm just kind of like, do I do that again? Do I, like, I don't know. This one started out great because, all right, here was the deciding factor, was that they took the remaining cast of Next Generation. I'm talking Patrick Stewart, Jonathan Franks, LeVar Burton, Michael Dorn, Gates McFadden. I mean, you have the whole cast. You have the entire cast, what's left of the Next Generation. And they announced ahead of time that all of them are coming back in for season three. And this is going to be the final season of Picard. Which, you know what? I like that. It creates an event. It creates an anticipation as if they're doing this great, well, if you don't see it now, you're not going to see it ever again, despite the fact it's going to be streaming on Paramount for the next 50 fucking years. But if you miss it, you're out of luck. They're playing on your emotional heartstrings, and I dig it. So what they did here, the show opens with Dr. Beverly Crusher, and she's out of Starfleet. She said, fuck you guys, I'm going home. And she's doing the 24th century version of Doctors Without Borders. She's got her own ship. It would have been much cooler if the ship was Firefly class, but anyway, that's just me. But she's got her own ship, and she is going to planets to administer medical aid for planets that the Federation might be ignoring. So yeah, she's totally doing this whole Doctors Without Borders thing. And first thing we see is her popping out of bed. She jumps up. There's an alarm going off. Her ship is being boarded, and she's in a firefight. We are 5 minutes in, and we're watching Dr. Beverly Crusher go all Sarah Connor on, we don't know who. We have no idea who these people are. They're boarding her ship, and she's gunning them down. We know she's got one other person with her. We don't know who it is. It's a younger dude. You see where this is going. You pretty much see where this is going. But she puts out a distress call to Admiral Jean-Luc Picard, and she says, I'm under attack. Here are my coordinates. Don't trust anybody, not even Starfleet. That's it. That is the first 10 minutes of season three, and I'm already hooked because I'm just going, wait, hold on. Why isn't Dr. Crusher in the Federation, isn't in Starfleet anymore? Why is she under attack? Why is she contacting Picard and saying, don't trust anybody? What the fuck is going on here? We see Admiral Picard at home. He's going through some old things. Some stuff is being sent to storage. Some stuff is being sent to some museum that we hear LaForge is running. Wait, LaForge was a chief engineer and now he's a museum curator? Kind of a demotion, I think. You know what would have been great? Now I think about it, instead of making him a museum curator, Geordi LaForge has his own holo broadcast where he's reading children's books to children. That'd have been fucking great. Anyway, So apparently he's a museum curator, and Picard is sending him, like, paintings of the Enterprise and, you know, basically sending him stuff for the museum. He finds his old communicator, which is chirping. And the message that Dr. Crusher sent is coming to that, and it's encoded. So he gets the message, he gets the distress call, don't trust anybody, not even Starfleet, meets up with Will Riker at a bar. That's the show I want. I'm not going to lie. That's the show I want. I want 30 years of Picard and Will Riker just meeting up at a bar and getting shit-faced. That, goddamn it, that's what I want to see. But anyway, Will's like, why, you know, what's going on? Why are you calling me here? And Picard tells him, hey, Beverly just called. Haven't heard from her in 20 years. Right there. Wait, hold on. Why hasn't Picard heard from her in 20 years? What's going on? And then Will Riker tells him that, well, none of us have. She just dropped off the map 20 years ago. Stop talking to everybody. Wait, the fuck? So can you see how this season is already, you're being presented with all these fucking questions. Brilliant. That is brilliant storytelling, because it's going to keep you coming back every week. Why hasn't Beverly talked to Picard in 20 years? Why hasn't Beverly talked to Riker or Troy or Geordi? What the fuck is going on? Why is she going all Sarah Connor on a group of space pirates in, you know, whatever fucking sector they're in? This is awesome. And here's where I have to kind of agree with the space dicks. Space dicks? Internet dicks. I'm sure they're space dicks too. But internet dicks, this is the show they should have started with. Again, I don't want to agree. You know what? Let's split the difference. This should have been season two. Season one of Picard, leave it the way it is. It's fine. Should have started season two this way. I'll split the difference. So yeah, that is Star Trek Picard. I'm loving it. We're only two episodes in? Three episodes in? Hell if I know. I think it's like three episodes. And I want to know, are they going six? Are they going 10? What are they doing? Because this is it. I forgot to tell you guys this. Back at LA Comic Con last December, I got to watch a panel. I got to record a panel, but again, my phone lobotomized itself and I fucking lost it. But I got to watch a panel with LeVar Burton. And he was talking about Picard, and he was talking about how great it was to be on the set with all these people that he hasn't seen, or at least they haven't all worked together in 30 years. It's going to be a reoccurring theme here, folks. He hasn't worked with these people in 30 years, and just to have that old camaraderie, to have that old magic back, and to know that they're bringing this story to a close. Not going to lie, punched me right in the feels. It really did. So yeah, that's what I'm loving about this season, is that we are seeing where our old cast is, where our old crew from the Enterprise, what happened to them, and how are we going to close the story? So anyway, that's Picard. If you haven't started watching it, I highly recommend it. If you haven't checked out the show yet, skip season two. It's basically what I'm saying. We're going to move on from there to The Last of Us. Now, I'm not going to lie, I never played the games. I have never played The Last of Us video games because I don't own a PlayStation. And apparently they're exclusive to Sony. Fuck you guys and your exclusivity agreements. Fuck off. I'm an Xbox owner. Fuck it. And so I've never seen this show. My first question was, how is this going to be different than any other zombie apocalypse show that we've watched for the last 10 years, 12 years? Well, first off, they're not zombies. You have my attention. Because the whole premise of the show, they start with a clip from the 1960s, this talk show in the 1960s, where this microbiologist is talking about how bacterial infections could evolve, and they could mutate into these things that threaten our existence. Well, right there. Right there, you've laid out the show, because there's no reason to put that clip in there unless it's going to dominate the rest of the season. It's going to be the theme. So we then fast forward to sometime in the 90s. I don't know. I didn't recognize it. I was there in the 90s, but I have no idea when this time was. And you have Joel, played by Pedro Pascal. And we have him. We have his daughter. His daughter was a bit of a shit. I'm not going to lie. Because we fast forward to Joel's birthday. And he wakes up and his daughter says, "Good morning, Dad. You know, got you this. I got you here. I got you this watch." And it's basically his old watch, but it's been broken. He's been meaning to get it fixed, and she got it fixed for him. It's pretty sweet, right? That's a really sweet, it's a very thoughtful birthday present. Up until the point where she admitted she stole money from his wallet to have the watch fixed. Kind of a dick move, I think. "Here, Dad, I stole money out of your wallet to buy you this gift." Just kind of and it wasn't like, I mean, if she's like 9, gotta let it slide. This bitch was like 16. So, yeah, she was definitely old enough to know better. Anyway, she was kind of a little shit. And that's when it happens. That's when the, for lack of a better term, we're going to say zombie apocalypse happens. Why? Please explain to me. Now that we've lived through COVID, we've learned that a virus doesn't hit everybody at 3 o'clock on a Wednesday and just turn your world to shit. Doesn't happen. That shit happens over weeks and months and months. No, in every zombie apocalypse movie, in every pandemic movie, in every fucking end of the world scenario, that shit just stops. Like right in the middle of the day on a Wednesday, all of a sudden your neighbors are trying to kill each other. Like, stop it. We've lived through a pandemic. We know better. Start writing that shit better. That's all I'm saying. This is what we've learned. Fucking stop. But that's what happens to poor Pedro Pascal. Him and his brother, I can't remember what the brother's name is because, well, I'm really horrible at doing show prep. But him and his brother, like, the world's going to shit. And like any good dad in a zombie movie, he says, "I need to get to my daughter and we need to get the fuck out of town." So Joel, the brother, and the daughter all get in the pickup truck. They start driving, and that's when you just see fucking hordes of infected. This is what I mean, folks. The virus doesn't hit an entire Midwestern town and just turn it upside down in its ass on a Thursday afternoon. It doesn't happen. But to Joel, the brother, and the daughter, shit happened just like that. They're driving out of town, and they are seeing hordes of infected, and you see this was the coolest part. You see planes falling out of the fucking sky because the pilots are infected. We're assuming, I mean, just the world is going to shit, and town's on fire. The military has rolled in, and they're trying to establish a perimeter. And the military does what the military does in these scenarios, just fucking kills everybody. And so what happens is Joel and his brother get separated. Joel grabs the daughter. They go one way. Brother goes the other way. They're separated. And they run into, Joel and the daughter run into these military soldiers who just gunned them down. Like, don't know if you're infected, don't really care, rat-a-tat-tat, right in your chest, you're dead. Joel gets shot, the daughter's killed, and that's where we start. That, we are 12 minutes into the first episode, and shit has hitteth the fan. Oh my god. So, Joel ends up killing the soldier who just killed his daughter. And we just see, the last thing we see in this particular scene is Joel crying over the body of his daughter. And I know there's going to be a bunch of fucking gamers out there going, "Well, you know you should have seen this because it was in the game." I didn't play the game, motherfucker. All right? I'm going to keep saying that has been the biggest criticism I've gotten lately. Anytime I post anything on Twitter, "Well, you know, in the game..." Shut up, you fat, useless fuck, okay? Didn't play the game. I don't want to hear, "Well, in the game." Fuck you, and you're well in the game, okay? So Joel, daughter, dead. We get a time jump to to like 12 or 15 years later and we're still living in the shit. Like, it is a total, like, just dystopian, like, world on the edge of fuck. Like, it's done. And we are basically, it's the Old West. It is, we have the technical advances of the Old West. You just have these shithole towns with a bunch of people who are starving. They're trying to get work. The government's taken over. And they are operating these independent little quarantine zones. And each quarantine zone seems to be like, it's basically autonomous. They just run themselves and fuck everybody else. And so Joel's doing whatever job he can do. He's asking for, well, do you have any other jobs? Yeah, we have sanitation. We have, you know. And Joel is living with his wife, girlfriend, whoever the fuck she is. And they're basically smugglers. They are basically doing some shady shit. Because in a time like this, you gotta do shady shit to survive. And he's talking to these two, and they're like, well, we got a job for you. And Joel, keep in mind, he has no idea what happened to his brother. So he has been looking for his brother for 12 years, 15 years, whatever it's been. And this group is helping him, and they said, basically, he needs a battery. He's been saying that he needs a battery for a truck to go out and look for his brother. And he talks to these two women, and they said, we have a job for you. Do this job, and we can probably get your battery. And he goes, okay, what's the job? And then they bring out Ellie. And Ellie's all of this, maybe 12, 13 years old, whatever she is. And they said, just get this girl to such and such QZ and deliver her here, and we'll get you the battery for your truck. So for the second show in a row, Pedro Pascal has been charged with taking care of a fucking child and delivering him to a specific destination. Dude, he needs to be called the babysitter. That is basically what Pedro Pascal is. He's the fucking babysitter. Like, you have a kid that's about to be killed by some terrorist forces, bring in Pedro Pascal. Your kid keeps getting kidnapped, bring in Liam Neeson. Like, this is the shit. A Liam Neeson, Pedro Pascal movie called The Daycare. That would be the shit. That'd be fucking great. Somebody pitch that for me. I don't even need credit. Just somebody pitch that movie for me. The Daycare, starring Liam Neeson and Pedro Pascal. Anyway, I'm fucking side questing here. So, but that's the premise of the show, is Pedro Pascal, Joel, is charged with delivering Ellie to the specific location. And again, you see where this is going because it's Pedro Pascal. He wants nothing to do with this kid. He even tells her one time, he says, you're just cargo. And we are what? Six episodes in? It's Sunday. So a new one dropped today. But through the course of this show, you see the walls between Joel and Ellie start to drop. And here's where the writing gets great. This is where the writing has become awesome. Joel has his walls up toward Ellie because the last time he was in charge of a teenager, he got her killed. So he doesn't want to let this girl in because it's too painful, reminds him of his daughter. And on the other side, Ellie, she's, again, 12, 13, however old she's supposed to be. And everybody she knows has left. They've either abandoned her or they died. And Joel is the only one that's ever fought for her, ever, you know, defended her, ever stuck up for her. So you see this really great relationship building between these two. And it's going to be awesome. It's really going to be awesome. And, of course, I've still got the internet dicks. But, you know, in the game, fuck you. Shut up. All right? I never played the game. Don't know where this is fucking going. This must be what all those fuckers who never read Walking Dead, this must be what they felt like when Negan showed up and he killed somebody, but we didn't know who it was. And I'm sitting there going, oh, you haven't read the comic? oh, you guys are going to be pissed. This must be what that felt like. Now I'm on the other side because I never fucking played The Last of Us. And let's be honest, I'm probably never going to play it. So just say it. Anyway, yeah, that's The Last of Us. And you know what? Since we're talking about Pedro Pascal and babysitting, let's fucking jump into The Mandalorian because the goddamn Mandalorian is back. Has it really been like a year and a half since Mandalorian season 2? You know what? Disney Plus has thrown so much at us that it started all blending together for me. It really just started to run together into this big tub of Star Wars awesomeness, because we had Mandalorian season 1, Mandalorian season 2, we've had the Book of Boba Fett, now we have Mandalorian season 3, Ahsoka's coming out pretty soon. I dropped out on Andor. I did, because it was just so much stuff coming at us that it was really hard to keep up with Andor. The first three episodes, I'm totally just tangenting here, but the first three episodes of Andor I thought were really good. But I did laugh my ass off when Diego Luna came in and said, well, this is it. I'm not playing Andor anymore. And again, the internet dicks are like, what do you mean he's not playing Andor? Well, this is a prequel to Rogue One, and he fucking died in Rogue One. So, yeah, not playing Andor anymore, you dumb shits. But again, got a little off track there. Mandalorian Season 3. Like I said, this all started running together. So I forgot where this dropped off. I really did. Oh, yeah. Mandalorian Season 2. Luke Skywalker showed up, took Baby Yoda, and the internet cried like you killed a puppy in front of him. Like, okay, now I remember. Wait, hold on. But he got Baby Yoda back. That was the Book of Boba Fett. That's right. Holy shit. See? All this stuff runs together. And Disney Plus, it's not healthy. Give us a break. Give us a chance to, you know, take a breath. Woosah. Let us absorb all this shit. Some of us have brain damage due to alcohol and head injuries. So take it easy on us. That's all I'm saying. And apparently the internet dicks agreed with me this time, because the moment I turned off Disney Plus, I look at my phone and there are people bitching on social media that the Book of Boba Fett fucked up the story arc from The Mandalorian. I see that headline. They didn't say fucked up, but I'm paraphrasing. And I went, wait, what do you mean it ruined the story? What do you mean it's ruined the arc? What are you talking about? Here's what I mean. Whoever wrote this fucking article is pretending that nobody that watched The Mandalorian watched the Book of Boba Fett. That happened. Whoever the narrow-minded fuckwit who wrote this article, they refused to acknowledge that there could be any crossover between the fans of The Mandalorian and the fans of Book of Boba Fett, because he was complaining, wait, he lost Baby Yoda at the end of season 2, and we just start up season 3 and he has Baby Yoda? Where did that come from? Shut up. Shut the fuck up. Okay? There couldn't be that many people that didn't watch Book of Boba Fett that watched Mandalorian. And I'm going to get on this fucking king of all side quests here. God damn it. I am going to tangent like I've never tangented before. Book of Boba Fett destroys canon. Thank God. I'm going to sit back with a lawn chair, a bottle of Jack Daniels, and fucking watch canon burn to the ground. And here's what I mean. I will acknowledge that there is a vocal minority of people that might have turned off the Book of Boba Fett before the end and Mando got Baby Yoda back. And here's why. I heard a chorus of bitching and just, I heard buttholes slamming shut like war drums off in the distance, because they said the Book of Boba Fett made Boba Fett look like a bitch. He wasn't a badass in Book of Boba Fett. He wasn't an ass kicker. Boba Fett would just shoot you instead of having a conversation, as where Boba Fett in the show was negotiating with people. And that's where canon starts smoldering. That's where it starts to catch a flame. See, because if you subscribe to this bullshit about canon, then Boba Fett was never a badass. In canon, here is Boba Fett's entire character arc. First, he was a snot-nosed kid who watched his dad, who was a badass, get his ass kicked by a Jedi who was a bigger badass. Mace Windu cut Jango Fett's head clean fucking off, and Boba watched it. We move on to the Clone Wars. Boba Fett, who's still a kid, plots revenge against the Jedi who killed his father, and Boba Fett fails every fucking time. We then smash cut to A New Hope, where George Lucas re-added Boba Fett for no fucking reason whatsoever, so he got a cameo there. He then shows up in Empire Strikes Back because there's a bounty on the Millennium Falcon. But we never see Boba Fett catch the Millennium Falcon. He tells Vader where Han Solo and the Millennium Falcon is. So at best, Boba Fett is a paid snitch, not a badass. And the last time we see Boba Fett, he died screaming and flailing and getting eaten by a sarlacc. There it is. There is the entire canon character arc of Boba Fett. So everything that made him look like a badass was those books and those comics that are quote unquote no longer canon. All right. So if you want a bitch that canon is important and it holds the Star Wars universe together, well, then you sit down and you fucking enjoy the Book of Boba Fett, because guess what? Boba Fett was never a fucking badass. Dude, I've been arguing this for years, and to finally have an example to put in these fucking angry nerds' face and go, here you go. Here you enjoy your canon, motherfuckers. Anyway, I told you that was going to be the king of all tangents, and I regret nothing. Anyway, so yeah, that is the internet dick bitch, is that, well, season 3 of Mandalorian started, and he has Baby Yoda back. How to get Baby Yoda? Well, shut up. Don't act like you didn't watch Book of Boba Fett. And if you didn't, go back and fucking watch it now. Now that you understand everything is canon, go back and suck on it. Anyway, this show is way more aggressive than I meant it to be. Episode 1, season 3 of The Mandalorian. You see Mando, Din Djarin. Yes, I know his real name, but fucking Mando is way more catchy. You see Mando flying around in his little fucking Nubian fighter, which got, I'm sorry, but compared to the Razor Crest, that's gotta be a bitch. Mando is basically sitting in a tanning bed and flying from planet to planet. That just has to be uncomfortable as shit. At least in the Razor Crest, he can get up and walk around a little bit. But anyway, I was getting claustrophobic watching that shit. So we start the episode with what I thought was a flashback, because we see the armorer and she is building armor for a new Mandalorian, for a foundling. She carries the helmet out of this cave, and you just see an army of Mandalorians. They're on this beach, and you see this kid who's in full Mandalorian armor except for the helmet. And she is basically initiating him into the tribe of Mandalorians. When all of a sudden they're attacked by a fucking megalocroc. This was a giant prehistoric crocodile, like the crocodile that attacked me in fucking Resident Evil 4. That took me 3 weeks to beat the goddamn thing. Anyway, I'm not going to tangent anymore, because that last one took it out of me. But I'm still thinking this is a flashback, and I'm thinking the foundling was Din Djarin. I thought that was, you know, we're looking at him as a child. No. Here comes Mando zipping in on his Nubian fighter and just destroys the shit out of him. He just blows the shit out of this prehistoric crocodile, and he lands, he gets out, and these Mandalorians are such a dick to him. They're like, oh, oh, it's this fucking guy. Like, yeah, this fucking guy who just saved you from a 2-ton crocodile, you dicks. Anyway, he talks to the armorer, and she's telling him, you're still a cast-off. You're still, you know, an undesirable. Like, get the fuck out of here. You do not... You made the Mandalorian mistake of taking your helmet off. I would think saving your life from the 2-ton crocodile, you know, we're square, but I'm not a Mandalorian. And he basically says that he is going to go back to Mandalore because apparently there is something in Mandalore prophecy, lore, whatever you'd call it, that if he bathes in the waters underneath the castle, all of his sins are absolved. So apparently Mando saw a vision of Prince, and Prince told him he had to bathe in the waters of Lake Minnetonka underneath the Mandalorian fucking prison, whatever it is. I have no idea. Prison, palace, whatever fuck it is. Anyway, so that's pretty much going to be the quest for this season. It's going to be the redemption of Din Djarin, which is hard to say. Mando is much easier. I think that's why I don't say Din Djarin very often, because my tongue has a stroke. Anyway, so that, yeah, that looks like it's going to be the point of season 3. It's going to be the motivation. We close the episode out with Mando going to see Bo-Katan, and he tells her his plan. He tells her, like, I'm going to Mandalore, and I'm going to prove the planet's not dead. And Lake Minnetonka underneath the Mandalorian palace is still there, and I'm going to bathe in its waters, and you fuckers have to take me back. It's a loophole. So, and that was it. That was all that happened. That was the entire first episode, 36 minutes long. That's all we got. You know what? Here's the thing. Like, Disney does this thing where it kind of, like, teases you for the first half of the season. Like, the first half of any season, the episodes are, like, between 35 and 42 minutes long. And then by the end of the season, you have 1 hour, maybe 90-minute episodes. But basically, Disney likes to tease you and play with your nipples before we get into the fun shit, which is always the back half of the season. So that's The Mandalorian, one episode in, and let's face it, I'm already hooked. Once you hear the Mandalorian music, like, I'm in, fuckers. You guys have not led me wrong yet, so there we go. So we are going to go ahead and close this out with AEW Revolution. You know what? This is a goddamn good show. This was a really good show. We opened up with Chris Jericho versus Ricky Starks. Pretty Ricky is what they call him. And I, you know what? I have A&E's WWE Rivals right now. It's on my TV. It's muted. And they are doing, it's a rerun from Stone Cold and The Rock. I did not realize how much Ricky Starks has stolen his look from old school Rock. The shirts, the haircut, the sly little smirk. Like, oh my God. Here's what I've learned about AEW. And maybe it's just wrestling in general. I haven't been paying that much attention. But pro wrestling is now all these guys that grew up in the Attitude Era just doing that shit. You have MJF, who is essentially a Jewish Roddy Piper. That's basically what MJF is. You have Ricky Starks, not even influenced by The Rock, ripping off The Rock. I guess he's hoping none of us saw in the late 90s. I don't know. The Young Bucks doing 317 super kicks in every fucking match. You know what? I'm not even going to blame the Young Bucks. That's just pro wrestling and indie wrestling in general. The super kick has basically become the new wrestler's handshake. Like, everyone's doing that shit. So anyway, Chris Jericho, Ricky Starks, this was a damn good match. This match told a great story. In the go-home show on Dynamite, we saw Ricky get jumped by Chris Jericho's crew, and Ricky came in with his ribs taped, which is only a pro wrestler thing. I did sports medicine for 3 years. I've never taped anybody's ribs. You have a rib injury? You're fucking sitting out. Sorry, bro. And but the rib injury played into this match. They used that to tell this story and to build the drama. Can Ricky overcome this injury? Can he overcome this rib injury? And they did a, I mean, they really did a great job of telling that story. This match did, however, wipe its ass with stipulations. Because the stipulation going into this match was that Jericho's crew was banned from the building. Two-thirds of the way through the match, here comes Sammy Guevara just marching his monkey ass down the aisle for no fucking reason whatsoever. He did get jumped by Action Andretti, so Sammy Guevara never actually got involved in the match. But you wiped your ass with a stipulation. Because the stipulation is no one from Jericho's crew was allowed in the building. And then you just brought Sammy out because fuck it, that's why. But Starks goes over clean. First one in AEW to beat Chris Jericho in two consecutive falls. Which I call bullshit because didn't Jericho and Orange Cassidy do like a three-match streak or three-match series? Did Orange Cassidy not beat him two in a row? Anyway, moving on to the Jungle Boy and Christian Cage, don't call it a coffin match match. That's what it was. It was a coffin match. They called it the final burial, which I'm pretty sure is what Triple H's matches with RVD and Booker T were all called. The final burial. But what they did was they took, what AEW did was they took the coffin, and instead of having the coffin at ringside, they had the coffin up on the stage on top of a giant pile of dirt. So I'm sitting there going, is this a buried alive match? Is it a coffin match? JR, Jim fucking Ross, is slowly regaining his crown of greatest wrestling announcer in the world. Because Jim Ross, on commentary, admitted, folks, we've never seen this type of match before. We don't know what to expect. Okay. All right. Hold on. I'm trying to wrap my head around this real quick. You're telling me that the commentators, the people whose job it is specifically to tell the viewer what's going on, doesn't know what's going on? Is that the story you're telling me? Because, yeah, Jim Ross openly fucking admitted in this show, we have no idea what's going on, folks. That shakes my faith in the AEW commentary team. Like, you would not believe it. At this point, I'm looking at the commentators like they're Jason Bateman in Dodgeball.
I sure do like pumpkins, Cotton.
So this match starts, and they immediately go into the crowd, which is really fun for the two sections that they're fighting in between, and it's really fun for the TV audience at home, but pisses off 98% of the people that paid money to sit in the building. Like, that they fought up and down this stairwell right here, and section 112 and section 113 were having a blast. The rest of the building is going like, motherfucker, we dropped $80 on these tickets. What is this bullshit? I will say this match was booked like a grudge match. If you've been following the story that Jungle Boy and Christian have been telling, it's been a slow burn for the last 2 years. You had Christian come in, mentoring Jungle Boy, and everybody knew he was going to turn. Like, there wasn't anybody over the age of 12 that didn't know Christian Cage was going to turn on Jungle Boy. And then he turns, and just when we're going to get ready to start that program, Christian tears out his tricep. So, gonna need surgery, gonna be on the shelf for like 6 months. And they did some things to keep Jungle Boy strong, but you really couldn't tell the story without Christian. So finally we get Christian back, and these guys picked up right where they left off. And you know what? Christian Cage is a hell of a fucking worker. Christian Cage is fantastic, underrated as shit, and he has been the one driving this story. Christian is such a great, smarmy fucking heel. Like, Christian, I mean, for those of you who know, Vince McMahon once called Christian that creepy bastard. And that wasn't a storyline thing. That was a shoot. Vince McMahon said that Christian looked like a creepy little bastard. Which is funny in hindsight. The guy who got caught paying $17 million in hush money so that people didn't find out about his sexual harassment cases and sexual assault cases is calling somebody else creepy. That's just funny. But Christian has embraced this creepy little bastard thing. And he keeps coming out on AEW TV dressed like the worst Bond villain ever. He's got the sport coat blazer with the turtleneck underneath. This fucker just needs to carry a cat and just keep stroking a cat during his promos. That's the only thing missing. But he has done a great job of just telling this story about how he was Jungle Boy's mentor and Jungle Boy looked up to him and he was the father figure that Jungle Boy needed after his own father died. Like, that is that's some dark shit. And so this match was the perfect grudge match. It was the perfect blow off to this story. And it was a concerto finish where the thing that kept pissing me off is that Jungle Boy, and during this run, during this entire feud, Jungle Boy just kept getting his ass kicked. Like, there was no shine. Jungle Boy would make a comeback and he'd get his hands on Christian, but he'd always get his ass knocked out. Like, he would do something, he would hesitate, he'd get kicked in the nuts, he'd get hit with a chair, and Christian just always left Jungle Boy laying. So the finish of this match is Jungle Boy finally gets that concerto. And here is, I will say, I didn't actually get to see the concerto, and that pisses me off just a little bit. He has it lined up, except for the fact that the chair is backward. I'm going to break kayfabe here just a little bit. Here's how you do a concerto, folks. The guy's laying face down. He's laying his head on one chair. The chair has to be flat side up so that the part of the chair that you lean against, that comes out at an angle. You then swing your chair flat side down so that the two backs of the chair hit each other, make a loud clanging noise, but leaves a good 16 to 18 inches of space in between the seats of the chair so you don't really fucking kill this guy. Yeah, folks, concertos will work. That's how you do it. Here's the problem. The back of the chair needs to be away from you so that when you swing your chair, you don't kill the fucking guy. Christian's laying there on the chair. The back of the chair is toward Jungle Boy. And I'm going like, Jack, turn the chair around. Jack, turn the chair around. Jack, turn the fucking chair around. And just as Jungle Boy raises that chair up, my Wi-Fi cut out. That might have been God sparing me from witnessing a murder. I don't know. I don't know what just happened because the Wi-Fi came back on like 6 seconds later and Christian's motionless on the stage. So I don't know what happened. Christian Cage might be dead right now. I'm not entirely sure. Jungle Boy then takes Christian's corpse, ironically throws it in the coffin, and the rules are your basic coffin match rules. One guy puts the other one in the coffin, closes the lid, match is over. Well, like I said, the coffin is up on this platform on top of a pile of dirt. So as soon as Jungle Boy closes the lid, that coffin drops out of view. It just fucking dropped. And I started laughing because Christian's in the fucking box. That thing just dropped through the stage like it was the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror. It just fucking dropped out. And I'm like, poor fucking Christian, who's laying in the box right now. That had to suck. But other than that, no, it was a good match. I really enjoyed that one. It was what a blow-off grudge match should be. So we are 2 for 2, and we're only like 30 minutes into the show. I'm like super stoked because like a WWE pay-per-view, 30 minutes in, you would have seen like 4 video packages and you might just now be starting your first match. So 30 minutes in, 2 matches down, fuck yeah. The next one is for the Trios title. It's the Elite versus the House of Black. This one, okay. I will say that the Bucks and Kenny, they do what I refer to as video game booking. It's just move, 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 move. It's like 3,000 fucking moves. I don't even try to take notes anymore because there's no point. So this one, though, this match started out uncharacteristically slow. Like, I once saw this video of Kenny talking to, like wrestling school newbies. And he was talking to them about the importance of, you know, develop your style. You don't need to do what other people tell you to do. I don't know what chain wrestling is. I've never done chain wrestling in my life. Which pissed off, like, pretty much every indie worker that I know. What do you mean Kenny Omega doesn't believe in chain wrestling? Like, Kenny was fucking chain wrestling in this match. Kenny and Malakai Black went back and forth with some really great fucking hold-to-hold shit. It was really good. And like I said, I mean, for a Young Bucks match, this match started off really super slow and then built to a fever pitch. I have never said this about a Young Bucks Kenny Omega triple or six man match. This told a really good fucking story. This just really built up, like ramped up the action. I did realize that the Bucks are a lot harder to tell apart now that Nick Jackson stopped bleaching his hair. Like, they were super easy to tell apart when Nick was the platinum blonde and Matt Jackson was the brunette. It was really easy. A lot harder to tell them apart now. I will say that. But, like I said, this match was fucking great. They put the House of Black over like crazy. I think because Kenny and the Bucks are EVPs, I don't know if it's unfairly expected that they're just going to hog the spotlight. They're going to steal the shine and really not do anything for anybody. I'm not saying they've ever done this. I'm saying that I think that's they get unfairly, you know, blamed for that. And they made the House of Black look like $1 million. Not that they're not. I mean, those three guys are fucking amazing. But House of Black looked like killers in this match. It was awesome. And then when the House of Black went over, dude, I was shocked. I put my phone down. I was just like, wait, what? I have my phone in my hand. I'm watching the damn thing on my tablet. And I got my phone in my hand taking notes. And when Malakai Black pins Matt Jackson for the Trios titles, I went, wait, what the shit? I honestly did not see them going over, which was, I mean, that's what you're supposed to do. I got worked. I'll admit it. I got fucking worked in this match, and I don't care. It was awesome. So, yeah, House of Black, new Trios champions. We then go to the women's title match. We have Saraya versus Ruby Soho versus AEW Women's Champion Jamie Hayter in a triple threat for that AEW Women's Championship.
And the menage a trois of pain.
Usually you pay double for that kind of action, Cotton.
And I will say this, it was a match. That was, yeah. Yeah, it was a triple threat match, and there was a champion at the end of it. That's pretty much all I got, folks. This match was not good. It was, I mean, it had its moments. Wasn't I complaining at the last show about why everybody has a faction? This show reminded me of that, or this match reminded me of that, because you have Britt Baker walking Jamie Hayter the ring, and of course they have Rebel with them. You have Toni Storm walking Saraya to the ring, and you know they're going to add a third. And then you just have Ruby Soho. And again, we see where this is going. Here's another story that's been going on for a while, and nobody got worked on this. I will say that. Nobody got worked. Everybody knows where this was going, which is fine. Not every storyline has to be a swerve. We're not living in the Vince Russo era anymore. So this match, like I said, it was a match. It was a good match. Wasn't great. This was probably the low part of the show. I will say that. Which, not a slam on these three women, but when you look at all the other matches, yeah, this was definitely at the bottom of that barrel. But the post-match, that's what I'm talking about. So Jamie pins Ruby with a crucifix, which is cool. Basic wrestling. We're watching pro wrestling. You saw a women's champion win a match with a wrestling hold. Beat her with a crucifix. You then had Toni Storm jump into the ring, jump Jamie. You had Britt got her ass kicked outside. And the story they've been telling is that Ruby's like, do I side with Britt and Jamie? Do I side with Saraya and Toni? Who do I side with? And she's stuck in the middle. So here's where I think they overthought it just a bit. Just a hair. It was a swerve for a swerve for a swerve's sake. That's what it was. Because as Saraya and Toni are kicking the shit out of Jamie, Ruby jumps up, grabs Saraya, throws her out of the ring, grabs Toni, throws her out of the ring. She's standing tall with Jamie and Britt. So I'm going like, oh. Okay, because I was almost positive that Ruby was going to side with the other two. And then, just as I thought that, Ruby does her little version of a Pele kick and just clock Jamie right in the mouth. She then puts Britt down and sides with Saraya and Toni Storm. Well, then why the fuck did she jump Saraya and Toni and throw them out of the ring? Guys, we don't need to swerve that bad. Everybody knew that this was going to be, it was going to be Saraya and Toni and Ruby against Britt and Jamie Hayter and Hikaru Shida. It was going to be the AEW Originals versus the goth girls that every nerd guy wants to date. That's pretty much was going to be the sides here. Why did we need to do the false swerve 8 seconds before doing the real swerve when a swerve wasn't fucking necessary? I don't get that. But anyway, it was a match. We move on to the Jon Moxley and Hangman Adam Page in a Texas death match. Even though the show was in San Francisco. Explain that one to me. Why is there a Texas? At least when WWE does a street fight, they find a way to tie in the city. Like a Music City street fight or some bullshit like that. I guess you can't really do a San Francisco death match. No. San Francisco death match sounds like a hate crime. Okay, yeah, Texas death match. I get it. All right. Again, this was a hot start. Really hot start. Moxley's coming, you know, because Moxley is the only one allowed to enter through the crowd. And just as he enters the crowd, Adam Page starts kicking his ass outside the ring. Again, these guys are fighting in the crowd, pissing off 98% of the building. Nobody here wanted to pay between $80 and $150 to watch this show on the big screen. You know, I could have been sitting at home doing this shit, you assholes. Anyway, the match isn't 5 minutes old when Jon Moxley is taking barbed wire to the face. This fucking guy. Oh my God. Jon Moxley has bled more in AEW's last 3-year history than Ric Flair did his entire 40 fucking years in the wrestling business. All right? Jon Moxley has bled so much from the face. I'm shocked his face still has blood. I really am. Oh my God. And there was so much barbed wire in this match. So much barbed wire. Like I said, Hangman Adam Page takes a string of barbed wire, just rams it into Moxley's forehead and starts grinding it back and forth. At one point, Moxley wrapped barbed wire around his fist and starts punching Adam Page in the face. Adam Page, at one point, wraps barbed wire around his own rib cage and does an Orihara moonsault from the top of the from the top rope to the outside. Explain that to me. Explain why you would wrap barbed wire around your own rib cage and jump on somebody. That, oh my God. One thing I did laugh at, one thing I was just immensely entertained at, there was so much barbed wire in this match that had to be a rib on Taz. It really did, because Taz is from Brooklyn, and New Yorkers don't pronounce their R's all that well. So you could hear how hard Taz was trying to say barbed wire. Barbed wire. And halfway through the match, you could hear him just say, fuck it, and started calling it Bob Wire. Yeah, like Bob's Burgers. Same shit. Like, you can't tell me they weren't ribbing Taz here. But this was your typical Jon Moxley AEW death match, which isn't a bad thing, but you're going to see some shit. You were going to see some shit that you're like, that looks stiff as fuck. At one point, Moxley goes under the ring, because under the ring, most people don't know this. If you've never been in the wrestling business, under the ring is like a TARDIS, and it's actually bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. So you can have so much shit underneath the ring. And if you need a chair, you need a kendo stick, you need a table, you need a giraffe named Abraham. It's all under the ring. It's fucking all underneath the ring. And Jon Moxley goes under the ring. He grabs what had to have been a 30-foot chain and 2 bricks. Why is there a 30-foot chain and 2 bricks under the ring? Because it's a TARDIS, and it's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. My only question is, was there only 2 bricks? Was there a wheelbarrow full of bricks and he only needed 2? That's my only question. But he takes these bricks. At one point, he takes the bricks and he puts one underneath Hangman's hand. He puts another brick on top and proceeds to stomp the bricks on Adam Page's hand. That looked like it sucked. Not gonna lie. And I love wrestling crowds, because as soon as the bricks came out from under the ring, they just started chanting, "You sick fuck." 20,000 people chanting, "You sick fuck," at Jon Moxley. And it's not like you can censor the crowd. That was great. These guys beat the living shit out of each other. There were everything, like I said, was covered in barbed wire. You had steel chairs covered in barbed wire. You had tables covered in barbed wire. There was plywood boards for no apparent reason, except for the fact that you needed something to nail the barbed wire to. That was the only purpose that these fucking things served. In the end, Hangman actually went over. This finish. At one point, Moxley takes this 30-foot, 40-foot chain, whatever it was, and wraps it around his own neck. I thought, like the Junkyard Dog, JR said Bruiser Brody. Both are valid. I'll give it to him. Both are pretty valid. But for no reason, wraps this chain around his neck, goes for a clothesline on Adam Page. Page sidesteps, grabs a hold of the chain, flings Moxley over the top rope, and the Hangman literally hung John Moxley by the neck, by this chain, and Moxley tapped out. So, again, I've said it before, I'm not a fan of death matches without a story involved. This story was great, and so I have to give it up. This match, this was really good. This, I'm shocked nobody died, but this one was really good. Now, up to this point, AEW has thrown a lot at us, and at this point, the show's only maybe an hour and a half old. I'm not going to lie, I got blown up watching this show. This was, the show up to this point was so good, and I was so into it, that the next few matches, just, I was worn down. Because the next match was the TNT title match, Samoa Joe versus Wardlow. I just look at my notes, and it's my notes say Samoa Joe versus Hangman. So that was the pause. I'm looking going like, no, Hangman wasn't in this match. Samoa Joe versus Wardlow. This was your typical big man battle. This was a mean guy match. It was just two big dudes beating the shit out of each other. This was Kong versus Godzilla. If Kong and Godzilla jumped off the top rope and did suicide dives on each other. That's what this was. But they're big dudes. They did what big dudes do and just wailed on each other. And it was damn good. I will say the finish was really clever on paper. Because what happened, Samoa Joe was going to use Wardlow's powerbomb symphony, where he just picks a dude up and just powerbomb after powerbomb after powerbomb. And Joe powerbombs him, picks him up for the second one. Wardlow counters, puts on Joe's coquina clutch. See, almost fucked that up. Coquina clutch, which is a rear naked choke. It is your basic rear naked choke. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu 101. It's like the first thing you learn when you go to a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu class. But could you have spent a little time teaching Wardlow how to put on a rear naked choke? It's not that hard. Left hand goes up underneath the chin, grabs either the bicep or the shoulder of the left arm, the left elbow folds, putting the left hand behind the guy's head so he has a forearm across his throat and the left hand pushing down the back of his head, putting pressure on the throat that's against the forearm. That took me how long? 10 seconds? 12 seconds to explain? Wardlow put on the worst rear naked choke that any 10-year-old white belt could have got out of. Basically, what Wardlow did was hug Joe's head. He wrapped one arm underneath the chin, wrapped the other one around the forehead, and just hugged Joe's head until Joe tapped out. That was the finish, folks. That, yeah. So, new TNT champion, Wardlow. Good match, not a great finish. We then go into the AEW Fatal 4-Way for the tag team titles. You had the Guns versus Jeff Jarrett and Jay Lethal. You have the Acclaimed. And you have my new favorite team of Orangehausen. And this match was just a 4-Way what the fuck. All right, I'm going to pull back the curtain here, folks. 4-Ways are a lot of fun to be in. And as I say that, I realize that came out a lot dirtier than I meant it to. Pro wrestling fatal 4-ways are really fun because it's just, you don't have to do a lot of storytelling. It's just spot after spot after spot. And what happens a lot of times is that the entire match is built on you hit your spot and that person rolls out of the ring. You turn around, somebody hits their spot on you, you roll out of the ring. Another person comes in, hits their spot on them, that person rolls out of the ring, and so on and so forth. Rinse, lather, repeat. That's pretty much the basis of every fatal 4-way ever. Who's hitting their spot? Who's getting hit by that spot? who's rolling out of the ring and who else is coming in so they can hit a spot. They're a lot of fun to watch. They're a lot of fun to be in. Not a whole lot of fun to put together, because there's a lot of shit to keep in your head. Like, okay, where am I at? Who am I hitting? I'm getting, okay, cool. I'm hitting this person. Who's hitting me with something? All right, I'm rolling out. Who's hitting them? Who hit that person? Who's back in the ring? Wait, am I back in the ring now? Do I get, what the fuck is going, that's pretty much my mind in every Fatal 4-Way I've ever been in. Yeah, that's pretty much how it goes. So, and that was this one. That was this match. It was just, who's hitting their spot? Who's getting hit by a spot? Who's rolling out of the ring? That's what this entire match was. You had all the puppets outside. Satnam Singh, oh my God. Satnam Singh is basically the Indian Omos. He is AEW's big, immobile, seven-footer who's never going to be a good wrestler. Every company's got to have one, and Satnam Singh is AEW's. But Satnam is the perfect example of what I'm talking about. Hit your spot, turn around, get hit with a spot, roll out of the ring, and get the fuck out of there. Satnam grabs two people by the throat. I can't remember who it was, because the show's dragging and this match isn't very good. Grabs two guys by the throat, double choke slams them both. Turns around, ends up grabbing Danhausen by the throat. As he goes to choke slam Danhausen, here comes Orange Cassidy with an orange punch. Satnam takes the orange punch, puts Danhausen down. Danhausen hits Satnam with a dick punch, which doubles him over. Billy Gunn comes out of nowhere, does a famouser, and Indian Omos doesn't so much take a face bump as much as he just falls forward and lands on his head, and somehow lands, he manages to land under Billy Gunn. Billy Gunn has been doing the famouser for 20-something fucking years. I've never seen Billy actually land on somebody. Satnam gets dick punched. He's hunched over. Billy Gunn goes for the famouser, and somehow when they hit the mat, Billy's ass was on top of Satnam's shoulders. I have no fucking clue how it happened, but it happened. Satnam rolls out of the ring, and we never saw that fucking guy for the rest of the night. Anyway, the Gunn Club goes over by pinning Danhausen, retaining their titles. So yeah, that happened. Sometimes I wonder if, and this isn't just AEW, this is pro wrestling in general. Did you just book a match to do a post-match angle? Is that what happened? Because there was no reason for this to be a fatal four-way. There was zero reason the Guns beat, the Acclaimed for the titles. You could have just easily done a rematch. Where the hell did Orangehausen and Jared and Jay Lethal come from? But they did a fatal four-way. The Guns retain. And then you hear FTR's music. FTR is back. So they came down. They did a run-in. They did a 20-second brawl with the Guns. And somehow Dax got busted open. Like, Dax legit got hard-wayed. Because, again, this was a 20-second brawl. The Guns get tossed, and the camera zooms in on Dax, and he's bleeding from the right eyebrow, like, a lot. And I'm going, like, this fucking guy didn't gig himself on a run-in. There's no way in hell. Like, he had to have gotten hard-weighed. So, yeah, FTR's back, and that's going to be cool. Which brings us to our main event. It is a 1-hour Iron Man match, but you can't call it Iron Man match. So a 1-hour match between Bryan Danielson and MJF for the AEW World Heavyweight title. And after the promo that Danielson cut on the go home episode of Dynamite, I thought it was a shoo-in. I thought, like, there's no way Danielson is going to cut that promo and not go over for the title. So when Danielson comes out first, MJF comes out with his satanic children's orchestra, which annoyed the shit out of me. It really did. This whole Max calling himself the devil, like, oh, fuck, bro. You know the last guy that called himself the devil was Kevin Sullivan. And he pulled it off. Like, Kevin Sullivan had the satanic gimmick where you believe this fucker worshiped the devil. Max, it's just a non sequitur. He comes out with a devil mask. He has this children's satanic orchestra, because they all come out in black clothes with these black devil masks on, looking very Eyes Wide Shut. And this poor orchestra wasn't mic'd for shit, because I'm watching them play their instruments and I can't hear a damn thing. Like, oh, you poor bastards. Like, they paid this, what had to have been like a 15 or 20 piece orchestra. You paid them to come out, they're playing, and I don't hear anything. So I'm just like, oh, I hope they paid you guys well, because it sounded like shit. And then Max comes to the ring in his gear with the devil mask on. I'm like, would you please stop with this devil bullshit? Now just, I will say this though. He took the mask off, takes his gear off. Holy shit, that guy is in shape. Like, Maxwell Jacob Friedman, he's always been in good shape. Like, he's always had a great physique on him. This fucking guy, oh my God. This dude had like an action hero movie physique going. Like, oh. As I say that, I'm a dumb shit. Yeah, MJF has just been filming Iron Claw. The Kevin Von Erich movie. Or Kevin Von, excuse me, the Von Erichs movie. So, yeah, of course he had a fucking Hollywood action hero physique. He's been playing Lance Von Erich. I'm a dumb shit. Anyway, that's my fault. I did notice, now that he's a champ, he can actually afford tanning. He doesn't have the creepy self-tanner hands anymore. So this fucking guy can actually afford tanning now. So, hey, when you're the champ and you're making champ money, you can do champ shit. Now, as for the match, this match was worked brilliantly. This was great. See, the psychology behind a one-hour match is you don't want to go out there and shoot your load in the first 20 minutes. But at the same time, you don't want to grind down the pace so much that the crowd gets bored. Anyone else remember that Shawn Michaels Bret Hart Iron Man match? Remember how many people walked out during that match? That was a damn good match from a pro wrestler's point of view, from a trained study the business pro wrestling point of view. That match was fucking great. From your average pro wrestling fan, fuck this shit, I'm going home. Go back and watch that match and watch the crowd, how many people walked out. That match, as great as it wasn't exciting enough for the crowd. But at the same time, they didn't go out there and just blow themselves up in the first 20 minutes. There's got to be that sweet spot there. And these guys did nothing. These guys did fucking nothing for like the first 20 minutes, and it was great. You had MJF doing just old school heel shit, where he would just jump out of the ring, walk around the crowd. At one point, he jumps the rail and starts walking, looks like he's leaving. Fuck no, it's an Iron Man match. He gets counted out, loses the title. But he's walking through the crowd, and at one point, I shouldn't laugh at this. I should not laugh at this. But he's walking back to the crowd. He sees this woman she's got her phone in one hand. She has an empty cup in the other. You can see there's still ice in the cup. So whatever she bought is gone, and there's just ice and water in there. MJF grabs the cup, takes the cup from her, and throws the water on the kid sitting next to her. Heat. That is fucking heel heat right there. And I just started laughing because that is old school heel shit. That is one thing that the Attitude Era fucked up to this day, is everyone wants to be the cool heel. Everyone wants to be the DX, and they want to, that's another thing. Oh my God, how many fucking wrestlers am I going to see nowadays doing fucking crotch chops? The last WWE show, the AEW show tonight, so many fucking people doing crotch chops and telling people to suck it. Stop that shit. Just fucking stop. All right? But that's what I'm talking about. Everyone wants to be the DX and tell people to suck it. Or they want to be the NWO. Everyone wants to be the cool heels. MJF said, fuck that. I'm going to make this little bastard cry. And he did. Oh, it was great. It was great. I would say MJF is as good of a heel as Edge was. Because Edge, during his Rated R Superstar days, Edge did nothing redeeming. Edge made you hate him because that's what a heel is supposed to do. A heel is supposed to make you fucking hate this guy to the point that you're willing to pay money to see somebody, anybody, kick this fucker's ass. That's what a heel does. And MJF fucking threw water on a little kid and made that little bastard cry. That is heel shit. Oh my God. Now, most of you are like, Greg, that's mean. That kid was having a good time and gets water thrown on him. That kid's fine. The staff went out. They got the kid. They brought him backstage. He got to meet a bunch of his favorite. There's a picture of him floating around on Twitter with Powerhouse Hobbs, with Will Hobbs, who's a hometown hero. Will's from Oakland. Oakland's only fucking a mile across the bay. Like, yeah, no, that kid's fine. But anyway, I side quested there. I laughed, though. I'm sorry, but I laughed my ass off. Anyway, match continues, and these guys just worked. I would not be surprised if 75% of this match was called in the ring, because it was basic shit. It was grab a hold, work a body part. The story coming into this match was that Danielson had a bad arm. So MJF worked that left shoulder. You also had the story where Danielson was working on MJF's left knee. So that's what these guys did. Grab a hold, work a body part, and pace yourselves. And then right around the 25-30 minute mark, that's when these guys picked up the pace, and these guys beat the shit out of each other until Danielson hits that running Bisaiko knee and gets a pin on MJF. So now we're up. Danielson 1, MJF 0, and they continue with these they continue with the match. And probably I would say a good 5 to 7 minutes later, MJF low blows Danielson in front of the ref. Ref says, fuck it, you lost another match. That's his qualification. So now it's Danielson 2, MJF 0. So MJF covers Danielson, gets a quick 1-2-3, pins him. Danielson 2, MJF 1. MJF covers him again. Ref counts 1-2-3. Danielson 2, MJF 2. And that's where the psychology of this match got to doctorate level. It got to genius level, because what happened? They're back to zero. They're back to two falls apiece. So I was almost positive that these guys were going to do the Bret Shawn match where they stayed 0-0 throughout the entire match and then go to sudden death in the end. And then Danielson picks up a fall. And then MJF gets disqualified. He ate a fall to get two more, to take it back up to 2-2. So now these guys are dead even. Fucking brilliant. This was absolutely brilliant. The finish of this match was great, though. So these guys, they ramped it up. Again, perfect psychology, perfect pacing. They ramped it up. These guys, toward the end, just beating the shit out of each other. Both bleeding, both have a bad, one has a bad arm, the other has a bad leg. Like, these guys beat the crap out of each other. And then the match ends. Danielson snatches a single leg crab on MJF with like 40 seconds to go. And it's coming down to, does MJF tap before the time runs out? And keep in mind, like I said, with the promo that Danielson cut Wednesday on Dynamite, I'm like, there's no way he is not winning this match. Time runs out. They're tied up three falls apiece. And I'm just going like, oh, no. You're going to sudden death. There's no way. There is no way. You guys are definitely doing the Brett Shawn finish. Tony Schiavone, on commentary, he's like, wait, hold on. I'm getting something. Okay. Yep. Oh, I'll definitely tell him. And then Tony Schiavone walks from commentary, tells the ring announcer, Tony Khan said to start this fucking match over again. Sudden death rules. That's what happened. Match ends, tied up 3-3, restarted under sudden death rules. And the sudden death was great because Max, like we're drinking buddies, MJF grabs the heavyweight title and he's about to hit Danielson, and the referee, Bryce Remsburg, who's getting to be my hero, Bryce Remsburg gets in MJF's face and goes, if you use the belt, you lose the belt. Hit him. I dare you. That ref was awesome. Like, I'm not going to fucking stop you. Fucking hit the guy. I don't give a shit. And MJF goes, ah, crap. Hands Bryce the belt. As Bryce is getting rid of the belt, MJF takes out the ring that he's had in his trunks for the last 65 minutes, apparently. Goes for the punch. Danielson counters. He then has MJF locked in the regal stretch. And as the ref's right there. He's checking on MJF. Are you going to tap? Are you going to tap? He sees the ring on MJF's hand, and you see the referee grab the hand and start to pull the ring off. And I'm going like, that's it. Everything's paid off. You've paid off the belt shot. You've paid off the ring shot. Danielson has MJF in the regal stretch. Regal got put out by MJF, so what better way to put Danielson over than using Regal's own submission to beat MJF? But MJF gets to the ropes, and referee's got to break the hold, so he breaks it. MJF rolls out of the ring. There's an oxygen tank. There's a little mini oxygen tank outside the ring that I forgot to mention. When the match ended in a 3-3 tie, you had medical personnel rush into the ring, two guys checking on Danielson, two guys checking on MJF, and they had an oxygen tank, and they put the oxygen mask on MJF, and I laughed. I laughed at the idea that he was so blown up, he needed oxygen. This part was great, because anybody who didn't realize that, you got worked. I got worked, and I loved it. Giving Max the oxygen after the 3-3 tie was a way to introduce the oxygen tank into the match. Max breaks the regal stretch, rolls outside. Danielson goes after him and catches the oxygen tank right in the face. MJF just swings that fucking thing over his head, and it sounded like he stiffed the shit out of him with that tank. He looked like he hit Danielson so hard. Rolls back in. He puts Danielson's own lapel lock on him. And Bryan Danielson taps out. Holy shit. This, like I said, I got worked. I thought after that go-home show, there was no way Danielson wasn't walking out of that match the new champion. And I got worked. So when I saw Danielson tap, I just sat up and I applauded and went, bravo. fucking bravo. That was great. So, yeah, AEW Revolution, that was a really great show. And we are coming up on the 90-minute mark. I normally don't like going this long. I normally like cutting off at an hour. But like I said, I procrastinated and I had to cover way too much shit. So with that, I am your host, Greg Hernandez, the Ninja Nerd Warrior. And you can find me on all forms of social media. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. If you like the show, thank you so much. Please like and subscribe, and don't be afraid to share the show. Send it to your friends, send it to your family, if it's something you think they would enjoy. And if you don't like the show and you really don't like your friends and family that much, want to annoy them with me droning on about nerd shit, fucking send them the show. I need the download numbers, folks. I don't care. I'll whore myself out. I don't give a shit. So with that, I am Greg Hernandez, and I will talk to you guys next time. Bye-bye.